Host intro. When Katherine Dunham's agent recently peddled the story of her life for a Hollywood film, producers were fascinated with the tale of a black woman who took the dance world by storm in the 1930s with a style built on Afro-Caribbean rhythms. But it seems no one recognized that the story was Dunham's. Few people in the 1980s seem to recognize her name, but they're being reminded as the Alvin Ailey Dance Company travels with a revival show titled The Magic of Katherine Dunham, now playing at Washington's Kennedy Center. Marge Halperin caught up with Dunham, now in her late 70s, to find out what that magic is all about.
Angelico, 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 Angelico.
Angelico, Angelico.
After just a few bars, it's easy to understand why Dunham's shows were a hit here and in Europe throughout the 1940s and 50s. Hers was more than a dance concert. It was an experience with lively South of the Border rhythms and earthy dances backed by exotic sets and colorful costumes, as in one of Dunham's favorite numbers, Angelico.
It was a thing of dancing the merengue, and the singers, I think, stayed pretty near their microphone over on one side of the stage, while one of the dancers and I did the merengue, which is sort of like the rumba, as I said. And from time to time, I would come back and sing in. It's a very light number, and very charming, and very Haitian.
Dunham is an expert on Haitian dance and culture. With a degree in anthropology from the University of Chicago, she spent several years living with villagers in Haiti, Martinique, and Trinidad. Dunham had danced since she was a child, and it didn't take her long to realize her two fields of interest were closely intertwined.
So when I went to the West Indies, it was with an idea of learning their dances, and then, as an anthropologist, why were they dancing, describing the dances, describing my participation in them, and it turned out that dance is extremely important in anyone trying to know a people.
Dunham shared her findings with anthropologists by writing books, and for the rest of us, she brought her knowledge on Afro-Caribbean cultures to the stage.
It's a spectacle, it's a show. It's not just a dance concert, it's thick and rich with costumes and scenery, as well as the imagery that she took from the original sources. So it's a theater in the highest sense.
While Alvin Ailey remembers the image of Dunham's dances, she remembers their cultural roots, as in the piece Ailey revives for the close of his show. Called Shango, it's the story of a boy possessed by a serpent god, a scene Dunham had witnessed in Haiti.
The boy that I had seen in the middle of a ceremony climbed a tree remarkably like one of the huge boa constrictors. And he made his way up into the tree and then stopped everyone, just as the boy does in our Shango on stage. He crossed his hands in the air and stopped everyone. So that much I did almost identically as I had seen it. Then I put in songs that I particularly liked from Cuba. We were in London first in 1948, and they were just absolutely taken by our show, by the color of it and the excitement. But during this particular number, Shango, one woman fainted, I remember, on opening night. The drums and our music was something that was just too much for people who hadn't had that kind of excitement.
For the most part, though, Dunham's Dance Company was praised wherever it appeared. Dates at the big clubs were hard to get, so Dunham often worked a circuit of smaller venues and wasn't too proud to play nightclubs where she was most popular. She quickly earned a reputation as a daring choreographer, as former Dance Company member Tommy Gomez recalls.
I remember when we went to Boston with the Rites de Passage, or Rites of Passage. This was a number that Miss Dunham did that caused quite a bit of controversy because of the pelvic movements. Martha Graham at one time referred to Miss Dunham as the high priestess of the pelvis.
Audiences overlooked that cattiness and kept Dunham in business. She opened a popular dance and theater school in New York with Marlon Brando and James Dean among her more illustrious students. George Balanchine brought Dunham to Broadway, and she jumped from there into film, performing in such movies as Pardon My Sarong and Stormy Weather. She wrote the song New Love, New Wine for the film Mambo.
It was for a nightclub scene. New Love, New Wine was one of our big things that opened at Ciro's. What could I say about it as a dance thing? It had this misty feeling of figures moving. I guess something in Venice must have given me this feeling, moving through almost fog and reacting to the lyrics, which were chiefly about the loneliness of having lost love, but at the same time finding a new love, as one must try new wine now and then.
There's a wind in my heart that's as black as the night, that can only be silenced by you.
Dunham kept her touring company going until the mid-1960s, when the Cuban Missile Crisis seemed to discourage interest in her Caribbean dances. By then, however, it seemed Dunham had had enough of dance. She turned back to anthropology, writing books and setting up a museum, performing arts center, and children's workshop at Southern Illinois University. She still works there in semi-retirement as professor emeritus. With Alvin Ailey's revival of her work this spring, Dunham's fancy has once again turned to dance. She says she doesn't have the time or energy to launch a new company of her own, but she expects the Ailey revival to spark more interest in her work.
I had almost the feeling in the New York opening and this opening, the feeling that the people needed, they were at a point where they needed this sort of combination of beauty and sound, because I think our music is very important, and content.
While Alvin Ailey keeps the Katherine Dunham magic alive on stage, she's more content with scholarly pursuits. Dunham's now working on a new book, The Mind Field. It's about her return to the realities of the racially segregated U.S. after her exotic studies in the West Indies. For National Public Radio, this is Marge Halperin reporting. Post-intro. Centuries ago, the church was the dominating patron of the arts. While that strong role doesn't seem relevant to today's society, one Chicago parish is trying to rebuild the bridge between art and religion. As Marge Halperin reports, the first step was to hold a national competition for a contemporary religious work, a 3-month search that ended this week. The Art of the Madonna competition was sponsored by Chicago's oldest church, the Catholic Old St. Patrick's. But it was the brainchild of the Reverend Andrew Greeley, the controversial author of several novels detailing the racier side of clerical life. Greeley put up half the $10,000 prize money, expecting that many of the entries would also draw controversy. Noting that Pope Julius II used to scream at Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel, Greeley says reopening the dialogue between artists and the church is bound to create diversity and tension. He's not shrinking from that, and neither is the pastor of Old St. Patrick's, the Reverend John Wall.
If you're looking for an image of the Catholic Church, one might be that it's a house with a large attic in which nothing is ever thrown out. Every once in a while you go back up in the attic and you discover something that perhaps you hadn't noticed before. And one of our hopes in terms of this competition was to invite a contemporary world and the artists of contemporary America to look at that image of mother and child and Mary and Jesus, and to, out of their own personal imagination, out of their own creativity, and out of their own, probably their own deeper convictions and values about life and about this particular image, speak it again, create it again, say it anew.
But pulling art and religion closer is no easy task in the 1980s. Art historian Michael Camille, a University of Chicago professor specializing in medieval iconography, says that in some respects, contemporary art has usurped the role of the church.
One could argue that in a sense it's become a religious experience. The museum is now the place we go to worship at the shrine, in a sense. So that appropriation of the sacred by the secular museum, in a way, that only complicates matters. Perhaps what it takes is artists being capable of working outside that museal framework. I think that would be good, because people can actually say, once again, that art functions. It actually has a purpose in a particular place.
The sponsors of the Art of the Madonna competition think the church is a logical place for art to find a function. Juror Phyllis Tuckman, president of the American section of the International Association of Art Critics, says the contest has given her hope for a return to the traditional relationship between art and religion.
There would be something fantastic if instead of people going just to the museum on Sunday instead of church, that they went to the church and they went to museum or synagogue or what have you. But I found that comparison particularly odious, and I see no reason why people shouldn't be brought back into a religious environment on a Saturday or a Sunday.
And the wide range of entries to this contest suggests the art world is willing to grab the church's outstretched hand. As Andrew Greeley predicted, the more than 400 entries reflect a wide variety of contemporary styles, easily meeting the call to focus attention and thought on the theme of Madonna and Child. There's the canvas that, at first glance, looks totally gray, revealing the image of the Madonna and Child only on close inspection, as one might inspect one's own values. There's a display of 27 video screens arranged to look like a stained glass window, and the highly controversial conceptual piece that crowds several candles and ceramic figurines of the Madonna under a suspended test tube. The winner, announced earlier this week, is a diptych, two oil pastel and graphite drawings by New York artist Brian Hunt, known internationally for his bronze sculptures. Hunt was somewhat surprised to learn of what he characterizes as the political goals of this competition, insisting the experience has not drawn him any closer to the church. But after a few minutes of protest, he softened and explained why he entered, when he could have made more money by selling the pieces.
They weren't for sale. I wanted them back, because they're personal things. I thought if they were to end up in a church, it would be a very interesting and sensitive relationship between whoever sees it and, and the subject matter.
So it struck a chord with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was perfect. As a matter of fact, I framed them just for the show.
So perhaps a bridge has been built after all. It's strengthened by an exhibition at Old St. Patrick's of all 17 finalists, including the controversial test tube rendition of the Baby Jesus, or as that piece is titled, The Case of Baby J. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. In Italy, they call performance artist Dario D'Ambrosi the father of pathological theater, a name he doesn't like, but admits he may have earned. That's because D'Ambrosi has spent the past 10 years drawing theatrical portraits of characters walking that fine line between sanity and insanity. D'Ambrosi's now touring the Midwest with his latest study called Nemico Mio, or Enemy of Mine. It is, as Marge Halperin reports, about a man who crosses the line and takes his audience with him. A single acting class taken as a lark in the middle of a successful soccer career changed Dario D'Ambrosi's life. He shocked his family by chucking his sports star status to be an actor. D'Ambrosi zeroed in on his specialty in 1979 when, upon learning that the Italian government planned to close its mental institutions, he had himself committed to spend 2 months studying patients who would soon be turned out in the streets.
I live with the other people, sleep with them, eat with them, so doing everything day after day. I think it was a really incredible experience and very rich experience because I really understand a lot about this world, but at the same time I have so much material for working in my theater.
That's an extreme form of research, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, definitely. I didn't want to go to school about theater because I don't believe in a school. So I went inside, and after show you'd understand more about yourself too.
D'Ambrosi came away with a special understanding of the mentally ill and with a raft of ideas for his plays, which are usually one-man shows in the Italian monologuist tradition. Nemico Mio has two roles, but the second character utters only one word, serving primarily as a foil for D'Ambrosi's character, who slides in and out of sanity. He's dreaming of a trip to the ocean, but though the set is a stretch of beach, it rapidly becomes clear that D'Ambrosi is playing a mental patient who isn't going anywhere. In the climax of the one-hour play, D'Ambrosi urges his friend to find out why he's too sick to make that fantasy trip to the sea, telling him, "Look into my brain."
If you see something inside my brain, you must tell me. Only me, Tommaso. Tell me everything is normal. Tell me everything is normal, Tommaso.
When you talk with the mental people, say, "But what do you feel exactly?" They say, "I feel a ronzio." Like a buzzing. And I always say, "But how looks this buzzing in your mind?" Say, "Like a flies, you know, zzz." And we did a play like a buzzing of flies.
You see flies inside my brain.
D'Ambrosi captures the hysterical laugh, the gestures, the tics of the mentally ill in a portrayal so startlingly real that a reviewer for the Chicago Sun-Times asked, "Why would an audience want to see this?" The answer to that question comes from Tom Riccio, artistic director for the Organic Theater, host of D'Ambrosi's Chicago performances.
I don't do comfortable theater. A lot of American theater for me is getting much more, it's like TV on stage, whereas Dario, I think, wants to take people to a place that they haven't been and wouldn't normally go to. And you really just pull right in gradually, and until you start seeing the world and accepting the rhythms as conveyed from the stage, because there's real tension release repeatedly, and there's really far-flung, erratic, emotional shifts.
While Riccio thinks a dose of pathological theater is what American audiences need, D'Ambrosi's Nemico Mio co-star, Stefano Abbati, says it's shaking up Italian theater, too.
The theater of the avant-garde in Italy is very often a theater for, like, an entertaining, like a theater that make you feeling or clever or happy. I don't like it. It's a poison.
Though there is humor in this story, Nemico Mio is not a day at the beach. It's a squirmingly close look at the human mind. D'Ambrosi sums up his version of reality in the program, noting there will never be a science that will determine to which point your brain will resist.
I don't know. Sometimes I don't know if it happened to you. You may be in the bed and say, "Okay, now I'm losing my mind. Now I'm losing my mind." It just can't go like that. Yeah, because I talk with the people. How are they going crazy? It's really in an easy way. So it just makes me worry myself. There is never science that just decides when you go and when you're not, you know.
If science can't define the brink of insanity, it's a question to be pondered instead by this performance artist and by those audiences who dare join him on his voyages. The next trip will be led by Jean-Paul Marat and the Marquis de Sade when D'Ambrosi celebrates next year's bicentennial of the French Revolution by adapting Peter Weiss's Marat Sade. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. And the tag is Nemico Mio runs through this weekend at Chicago's Organic Theater, then travels to the Cleveland Public Theater and stops for a single performance at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. D'Ambrosi will be in L.A. and San Francisco in the fall. The Cleveland Rund is from May 19th through the 29th. The appearance in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan is June 4th. And following is the tease. Dario D'Ambrosi explains that he's formulated his pathological theater. He got this idea struck by the similarity between actors and mental patients.
The feeling, especially the feeling when you're acting, is very, I don't know, it's very crazy. You feel some strange feel inside, you know, your expression. Remember me always when I was inside the mental hospital. For that, I think there is very incredible relation between actor and, you know, just mental people. Because always both that want to escape from the reality in some way.
And one is acceptable in society and
yeah,
one's not.
Yeah, sure, definitely. To be actor is very cool, come dico, like say New York, you know. To be mental person is not cool.
Art can be used and is used as a very powerful healing force. Used properly through the right media. Some people would be better off using sharp pencils and rulers, and other people wallowing in a barrel of clay. It just depends on what the need would be. Good art is art that is whole and unified, complete. And that obviously indicates that some many diverse elements are working together to create this unity, which is pretty fascinating. On the other side of it, I think for many of us, the making of art, which is a creative act, is a very healthy act, and oftentimes is a healing act for many people. The goal is to somehow understand the workings of the brain so that you can apply whatever healing art has to making things and people more whole.
Host intro. The rich may not be the only ones who are different from you and me. Neurologists are discovering increasing evidence that artists and those successful with verbal skills may have had their careers chosen based on different formations in the brain. We know that certain parts of the brain control these different activities, and hoping to get a better idea of what makes a creative brain different, scientists met over the weekend in Chicago with art historians, art therapists, and artists themselves to examine the link between art and the brain. Marge Halperin reports. Typically, it's the left side of the brain that's dominant, controlling the logical, verbal functions and overshadowing the right side of the brain with its emotional, creative, and abstract functions. But sometimes that right side takes over. Creativity is unleashed and an artist is born. That's how the current neurological theory goes anyway, and there was plenty of evidence to support it at the Art and the Brain Symposium sponsored by the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. In a vivid demonstration of the role different brain functions play in the creative process, the symposium featured an exhibition of 60 paintings by artists with varying forms of neurological damage. A pair of paintings titled Golden Calf 1 and 2 shows the effect of a brain tumor. Before the tumor, the artist draws a full picture with color and images spilling over the four sides of the canvas. After the tumor has grown on the left side of his brain, the right side of his canvas is nearly blank. All color with virtually no defined images. A series of pictures by Boston artist Cynthia Goodhue delves deep into her mind, coming up with a chilling representation of the seizures she experiences as an epileptic.
This is my visual hallucination. In my right field of vision, I was in a forest at the time. It gets very distorted and it has a sense of just looming backwards. The perception is very distorted. In my left field of vision, I have bright lights, and these people are always like running around in a state of frenzy. And the bottom half is just blue, but it gets all smoky, and there's little flashes of light. So I'm painting what I saw during seizure, and so I'm very attached to this one, very attached.
Art can be used and is used as a very powerful healing force. If you lose your verbal possibilities, maybe imaging can help communicate and express. If you are having emotional kinds of problems, maybe through catharsis and through a kind of understanding through the image, insight can be gained into it.
Art therapist Don Seiden points to the work of another artist in this exhibition, a stroke victim who lost her speech but gained an ability to paint, something she'd shown no talent for before the stroke. The impact of neurological damage can also be seen in the work of the masters. There are many who will argue that Van Gogh did his best work as a patient in a French mental institution. Art historian Mary Ghetto has a theory about Francisco Goya. She thinks a neurological disorder, possibly Meniere's disease, spurred a series of paintings on the theme of balance, or as Goya experienced it, a lack of balance, done while he had frequent dizzy spells. Through those paintings, Ghetto argues, Goya was able to confront his problems and possibly even serve as his own doctor, healing his neurological wounds. She suggests that a series of 14 small paintings, known as Goya's cabinet pictures, are self-portraits. They begin with Goya as a bull, killed in a bullfight. They move through scenes of a freakish dwarf, marionette seller, robbers attacking a train, and they end with a burning theater, a scene that would be tragic, except that the audience members are rescuing each other from the flames.
You know, you went from this very pessimistic kind of reaction, that he's the dumb beast, not the master of his own fate at all, to this kind of more triumphant exclamation about man's humanity to man and man's ability to help one another. But certainly I think what helped him above all was his own art, and that he really did effect a kind of self-healing through this experience.
You think he's working out these stages?
Yes.
On canvas?
Well, on tin plate, as it happens. They were all done on tin plate.
That's a theory that demonstrates the type of clues that might be buried in a painting or sculpture waiting for an adventurous neurologist. Don Seiden is hoping some of the most adventurous got a push at this symposium.
You know, artists have sort of shied away from contact with the rest of the world in a sort of historical tradition, or at least they've been thought to, science has been very separated from the world of art, and education has had its own domain, and therapy has had its own development, and you know, it's time for people to begin to dialogue and to talk together. If creativity is anything, it is certainly bringing diversity into unity. That is maybe what this conference is about.
Finding a common humanized ground on which artists and scientists can meet is also the goal that led artist Cynthia Goodhue to show scientists her pictures of seizures.
It's not just an EEG, a graph, what they read. There's a human there, and there's feelings. And there is an experience that, as much as they try to classify it, I don't really think they can. It varies from person to person. And I'm also interested in, I guess, furthering the cause that people who have epilepsy are just like everybody else, and they just experience an electrical storm in their brain, that's it.
And Goodhue hopes that with more artists showing how it feels to have a seizure, tumor, or stroke, scientists will be better able to understand what those disorders really are. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Host intro. The education system in this country plugs every child into a predetermined slot. At the age of 10, a child fits into the fifth grade. A year later, he or she should be ready to move into the sixth grade. But what happens when a child doesn't fit that system, isn't ready to move along with others? Often, they're held back, the euphemism for flunking. But educators now suspect that policy has been doing more harm than good, and they're looking for ways to help children learn at their own pace instead of forcing them to fit the system. Marge Halperin reports.
You've got to accentuate the
positive.
Say it, positive.
Positive.
Eliminate the
negative.
Students at Beethoven Elementary on Chicago's South Side are working hard these days, nervously awaiting their next report cards, due out in 3 weeks. The last time cards were sent home, 250 of the school's 800 kids were told that because they were reading 2 years behind grade level, they'd flunked the first half of the school year and were being held back. Another 250, reading 1 year behind grade level, were told they'll flunk too unless they dramatically improve their skills by the end of the year. The school's recently assigned principal, Grace Dawson, says she took that drastic step, convinced her students had been, in her words, programmed for failure.
If we say it's okay if you can't read at the eighth grade level when you're in the eighth grade, and we say it's okay that you can't write at the eighth grade level when you're in eighth grade, we'll pass you on and you're working at the fifth grade or the sixth grade level. By the time that you get through high school, you will be so far behind that you will not be equipped to compete in our society.
However, many of the students' parents don't agree with their principal. Armed with studies that show students who are held back 1 year have a 50% chance of dropping out before completing high school, the parents boycotted Beethoven School until Dawson agreed to give the students intensive tutoring at their own grade levels. Michael Seals is head of the Beethoven School Parents Council.
The children hate to tell other children that they go to Beethoven School. Okay, when she done this right here, she tore down the children's self-esteem within them. And when you does that, it hurts. And a lot of times, it does something to that child where that child don't want to learn. And the parents say, why would she do this, you know, to make our children a laughingstock of City of Chicago?
That's the view many of the experts are taking as well. Meeting last week in Chicago, members of the National Association of School Psychologists drafted a position paper calling for more creative alternatives to holding back students. Peg Dawson, a psychologist for the Exeter, New Hampshire school system, says those alternatives can include flexible curriculum that adapts to the pace of each child, teaching in multi-age groups to stress skills rather than grade level, and peer tutoring, which she says helps all children work together regardless of their skill levels.
I walked into a third grade classroom, which was using cooperative learning. The kids were divided up into groups. They were learning a punctuation task, and there was a letter, dear so-and-so, up on the board, and they were supposed to put in the correct punctuation. They were working in teams. Each team had a blackboard on which they were supposed to put the correct punctuation. I entered the room at the point where they were supposed to share their answers, and I have never seen such excited kids. They were raising their hands, and they were just so enthusiastic and wanted to have their input.
Even with such creative teaching methods, some children still won't be ready to move ahead at the end of the year. For them, some psychologists suggest the creation of a few extra grade levels, removing the stigma of repeating a grade. Children who can't move on to a higher level with their peers are at least spared the embarrassment of staying behind with younger students. Ralph Worthing, a school psychologist in suburban Chicago, says it's a technique most often used to help students over the hump from kindergarten to first grade.
In effect, what it becomes is like a two-year kindergarten program. They call it different things, transition classrooms, transition programs, or developmental kindergarten, developmental first grade. What it, in fact, gives the students an opportunity for perhaps 2 years of more formalized schooling before they go into first grade without the concept of retention. It's a forward-moving program as opposed to just a repeat of a grade.
The extra money needed for that kind of special tutoring is not available in many of the hardest hit schools, including Chicago's Beethoven Elementary, where money can't be spared even for children several years behind in their reading skills. But Worthing says there are inexpensive ways to rescue flunking kids. He recommends basic training to involve parents, more active teaching to replace the abundance of bookwork in most classrooms, and school policies for flagging slow learners as early as possible.
And we call a statement sentence, so what kind of sentence? Declarative sentence? Okay. And
for National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
What kind of sentence is this? Listen carefully. The concert is today.
The stage.
Okay. What kind of period, what kind of punctuation mark does it end in?
Period.
I know that tune.
State.
A statement. What kind of?
Period.
A period. When is the concert?
Host intro. Tomorrow will be a big day for the residents of the small Swedish neighborhood known as Andersonville on Chicago's north side. These quiet streets, lined with what's said to be the largest collection of Swedish stores anywhere outside of Sweden itself, will be visited by royalty tomorrow, King Carl XVI Gustav. That's G-U-S-T-A-V, and Queen Sylvia are coming to town to dedicate a new Swedish-American museum. As Marge Halperin reports, Chicago's Swedish community is ready. Just as they did back home, the Swedes in the Andersonville neighborhood ring this bell every Saturday morning to signal cleanup time. Shopkeepers scurry outside at the sound of the bell, bringing their brooms to clean the sidewalks. One of the chief bell ringers is Sonia Sturlo, who confesses she is, in fact, a Dane, explaining they're just as clean as the Swedes.
I had people, we say I'm from Denmark, they say, oh, I was there once. We take a piece of candy and we just drop the paper. And everybody was staring at me, I pick it up so quick.
With that tradition, it's no surprise then that the windows of Andersonville's delicatessens, restaurants, and gift shops are gleaming. Nearly everyone has a message of välkommen to the king and queen. Lucy Valla has spent hours arranging the four windows at Ericsson's jewelry store. picking out Swedish glass, pictures of the king and queen, and other cultural paraphernalia that show a kind of reverence one might not expect from a dark-haired, dark-eyed Portuguese immigrant.
I'm not Swedish, but I feel like it. I like to maintain the under Soville with the Swedish flavor.
Vala's boss also likes Andersonville's Swedish flavor. He's a Korean who has carried on the Ericsson jewelry tradition for 30 of the store's 75 years in business. It's that dedication to the area's heritage that keeps this neighborhood so quaintly Scandinavian. And inside the old-world style shops, customers of all nationalities are abuzz with word of the king's visit.
What are you saying to yourself there?
No, the king is going to be here.
What do you mean? The king is already here.
Right?
Yeah, there he is, there he is.
Over the past few days, customers of Wickstrom's Scandinavian American Gourmet Foods would find saleswoman Gunvor Shimon not behind the deli counter, but crouching inside the store's display windows, arranging a mixture of blue and yellow deli foods among crepe paper streamers, also the colors of the Swedish flag. Tomorrow, she'll be strategically located across the street, where she'll get the best view of the king.
Yeah, well, everybody's proud of him, you know, and he's young, pretty queen, you know. So everybody loves him for that reason, I think. And it's something special. We don't have a king come every day.
Actually, this community gets a royal visit more often than most. This will be King Carl's third trip to Andersonville in 10 years. This time, he's coming both to mark the 350th anniversary of the first Swedish-American settlement in Delaware and to help dedicate Andersonville's new museum, featuring paintings by famous Swedes and a diorama showing Chicago's first Swede.
The first Swede that we know settled right in this area was Per Peterson. As a matter of fact, Peterson Avenue is named after him. And he became the biggest nurseryman in the Middle West. He planted about 65% of all the trees that was planted after Chicago fire.
Museum founder Kurt Mathiasen, speaking over the din of last-minute construction, uses a mixture of Swedish and English, which he calls Swinglish. He brags about all of the great Swedish Americans, from the founders of the Walgreens drugstores and the Seaburg Jukebox Company, to the architect who reversed the flow of the Chicago River to stop it from polluting Lake Michigan. This royal visit is just one more feather in the community's collective cap.
And I also mention everybody that wants to come up to Andersonville, even if they will be a little late. I promise I will not wash my hands after that I have shaken the king's hand. And for a donation of $10 to the museum, they can shake my hand.
That second-hand brush with royalty is actually a generous offer, since most of these adoring fans will get no closer to the king and queen amid what has been promised to be very tight security. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago. Host intro. A cultural renaissance of sorts has been underway in Spain since the death in 1975 of dictator Francisco Franco. The new democratic government views art as an asset, not a threat, and has helped engineer a major exhibition of contemporary Spanish artists, of the works of contemporary Spanish artists, which will travel throughout the United States this year. While some of these artists are well known, the exhibition is designed to introduce American audiences to the full scope of contemporary Spanish art. The show opened this month in Chicago, where reporter Marge Halperin had a chance to talk with the curator and with some of the artists about the significance of the title they chose, Época Nueva, or New Age. That is, that the show opened in April, in case this runs in May. It's not that General Franco had no interest in culture. It's just that his dictatorship had little room for art, according to Época Nueva curator Gregory Knight.
There was no encouragement. There was a very clear discouragement of contemporary art. Contemporary art smacked of revolution, and those years with Franco control were pretty unkind to the arena of contemporary art and to the freedom that artists felt to either travel and see other things or to work and show.
Under democracy in Spain, artistic freedom has come to mean government grants, new museums and community centers, and an effort to import exhibitions. While art certainly wasn't dormant under Franco, Knight says it has gained new energy under democracy.
All of this, to me, adds up to basically an art scene in Spain that's unlike almost any other country in Europe or what we know in America, because it's such a jump from closed to open. And it's sort of making up for lost time on a lot of people's part to where there's a lot of interest, a lot of activity going on.
The change in Spain's art world is more complex than a pre-Franco, post-Franco explanation would suggest. Now 36 years old, Chema Cobo worked both before and after Franco's death and insists his artistic freedom wasn't compromised under either government. But he worries about the overzealousness of democratic leaders.
We feel that the intervention of the politician and the government into the art is becoming kind of dangerous, you know. Art can be used in a way of propaganda.
They'll start encouraging certain kinds of art and discouraging others, for instance. Is that the sort of thing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, they are trying to encourage mainly, you know, this art that it looks more international, but they are missing one point that, you know, every country have to show, you know, their own roots. I mean, art comes with times to develop things. Politicians are in hurry all the time.
There is no way to overlook Cobo's roots when studying his large-scale paintings. His thick brushstroke creates a moody look with bursts of light at the end of these dark tunnels. It's a style Cobo characterizes as distinctly Spanish, as in the picture Amnesic Gate, the gate through which one passes without memory to create a new reality. The work is weighted down with a dark, smoky sky, pushing the eye to a fiery center buried in the scene.
That is very typical Spanish statement. Let's say it's to be either white, either black, either in the shade, either in the light. And this struggle, I think, has been important in all the history of the Spanish art or Spanish literature also. I mean, you can see El Quijote of Cervantes is half, you know, reality, half madness, you know. This kind of struggle, I think, of a way of thinking, way of behave, way of living, is part of myself.
Sculptor Miquel Navarro is also proud of the way his Spanish roots are reflected in his work. Using zinc and lead, which oxidize into a splattered white-gray surface, Navarro has arranged a city on the floor of this exhibition, small houses and landscaping spread at the base of a 4-foot cylindrical tower. On either side of this work, he has placed two complementary pieces, humanistic figures, one topped with a cupped, gutter-like head for collecting, the other with an inverted piece, unable to retain anything. These two, Navarro says, through an interpreter, are clearly Spanish works.
If, for example, he had been born in Germany or if he were a German artist, the work would reflect a kind of, potentially could reflect a kind of more rational, more intellectual kind of approach to the work, which is part of what we sometimes look at when we look at German artists. In his case, he's much more passionate, much more intuitive. A very different approach emerges from his own work, and he thinks it's closer to his own sort of Spanish background.
While the 10 artists in this show certainly don't represent all that's happening on Spain's art scene today, their work shows the diversity of Spanish art. Most of these artists draw on their roots, depending on whether they work in the north or south, in the cities or in rural areas. Francisco Liero from the northwestern Spanish mountains has a rugged style, chiseling works out of rough-hewn logs, letting nature share the job of creating his art. That and so many themes repeated in this exhibition are universal artistic messages, yet they're delivered with a distinctively Spanish flavor that can't be missed by American audiences as the show travels to such cities as Akron, Dallas, Coral Gables, and Cincinnati. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. A crude Irish bar becomes a Trinidadian rum shop as Irish playwright John Singh's Playboy of the Western World is transformed into Playboy of the West Indies by Trinidadian Mustafa Matura. Matura's play opened in Oxford, England, and had its American premiere in Chicago last weekend as part of the city's month-long International Theater Festival. As Marge Halperin reports, American audiences are surprised and delighted to find how easily this Irish classic makes the trip to Trinidad. Singh's story of a rural Irish village taken in by the boastful tales of a field hand who claims to have murdered his father was scandalous when first presented at Dublin's Abbey Theatre in 1907.
They thought it was a slur on the Irish. They thought that, they actually tried to stop the performance. Presumably, the play broke up in the third act when the word shift was used. You're not supposed to talk about undergarments on the stage. It was a slur on Irish womanhood. For Pegeen to fall in love with a murderer
University of Chicago English professor Mark Ashen finds every shocking element of Singh's story intact in Playboy of the West Indies. The Irish setting, and more importantly, Singh's poetry, easily adapt to the West Indies setting created by Mustapha Matura. Matura says it's the rich Irish dialect Singh used that first drew him to the story, pointing out the similarities in Irish speech and the way English is used in his own native Trinidad.
The idea of a beautiful rural community that is enthralled by the stranger, the storyteller, the visitor from outside who captivates it and becomes a hero. In Westerns, he would do it with a gun. In this play, he does it with the beauty of the speech.
Matura pored over Singh's script, translating each line into his own dialect and culture. There's the scene in which two villagers realize that bragging of his murderous deed has made the field hand a hero. They try to bribe him into taking a trip. Matura's version calls for a boat ride to Venezuela.
Which in the original, the half of a ticket to the Western States, which is America. I'll give it to you and my new hat and my breeches with the double seat. You see, already he begins to describe his breeches. I mean, he may have gone on to tell you how well it was stitched and where the pockets existed. And this is an aspect of the language that we share, will give life to the language. I choose a red flannel shirt.
And look, they say that the night has got a bit chilly down there out in the bush. I was going to carry these clothes too, but you could have them. Look. A new flannel shirt, brand new. Take it. See if it fits you. It bound to fit you. You and me is the same size. Take it and take the ticket and go now.
Singh's Irish poetry again takes on a Caribbean lilt as Matura reshapes the play's love scene. The field hand is trying to convince a barmaid to marry him, painting a picture of the fantasy life that awaits them.
He says, when the airs are warming in front 4 months or five, it's then yourself and me should be pacing Nefin in the dews of night. The time's sweet smells do be rising, and you'll see a little shiny new moon maybe sinking on the hills. It was finding aspects of Trinidad that were equally spectacular and beautiful in order to seduce and convince Peggy of the joy that was promised before her.
It's just you and me. And the rainy season coming. And we go just lie in bed and listen to it beating on the galvanized roof. And feel cozy like two small children. And at night, we go stand by the door and smell the hibiscus circling in the breeze and count the stars and miscount them to start over again. What do you say?
The two plays are at once the same and different. They tell the same story, describe the same course of events. But as West Indies director Nicholas Kent points out, the accent, both literal and figurative, is quite different.
In Singh's play, people are living on the poverty line in a rain-sodden island. And life is dour and it's extremely hard. And they find their liberation, in a way, through stories and romanticism in the long evenings, dark evenings. Whereas in Mustapha's play, because it's in Trinidad, it's rum-soaked. There's a sense of joy, there's a sense of sun. Mm-hmm. And it's a very much funnier play, I think, than Singh's play.
The similarities override the differences as Matura convincingly turns the Western world into the West Indies. The potato farmers of Ireland become sugarcane workers. A superstitious old Irish widow is livened up a bit in her transformation into a superstitious island voodoo woman. And the hard-drinking, storytelling villagers of Ireland turn out to be hard-drinking, storytelling villagers of Trinidad. Playboy of the West Indies has been praised as a logical and well-executed transformation. But Matura isn't stopping here. He also sees similarities between the Soviet culture and his own, and his newest project is an adaptation of Chekhov's Three Sisters, commissioned by London's Tricycle Theatre and titled Trinidad Sisters. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. This is the Lee Conklin Antique Organ Museum, Conklin, and the pronouncer for one of these cities I'm going to list for you is Moscow. You won't find the Lee Conklin Antique Organ Museum listed in any guidebooks, but just ask the folks in the southern Michigan farming community of Hanover, or even neighboring Horton, Moscow, or Jonesville, and they'll point you in the right direction. The collection of nearly 80 antique organs, one of the most extensive in the country, can be found in the gymnasium of the old Hanover Public School. And as Marge Halpern reports, it's time this local secret went national. At first glance, the museum looks more like a warehouse. The old school gym is jam-packed with organs. Tall pipe organs, smaller chapel organs, the old flat tops, parlor organs with their ornate carvings, and even a few portable models. All remnants of an era when you made your own entertainment. Tour guide and Hanover Historical Society President Francis Hartman pulls up a stool and the warehouse atmosphere dissolves as we're whisked back into a turn-of-the-century parlor.
Play the chorus again.
Oh, come to the church in the wild. Come to the church in
the second voice is that of 93-year-old Lee Conklin, the man who amassed this organ collection. A retired farmer, Conklin started in 1964 when a family friend gave him the organ that was the center of many a Saturday evening's entertainment in his youth. He refurbished that instrument to keep busy after his wife died, then toured auctions and private sales to come up with the other 72 organs that eventually filled his barn.
Well, I don't know. I had such good luck with the first organ, and I had such good luck picking that up. I guess the spirit moved, and I like to fix them up. That's how that's all come about.
Conklin gave his organs a new finish, repaired keys, and added whatever mechanical or decorative parts were missing, using the parts he did have to make a pattern.
That's Mason Ham on the top of here, but I made this here. I made that.
You made the whole thing.
Yeah, made the top.
Francis Hartman explains the walnut top on that organ flew off when Conklin was transporting it home from an auction. He made a replacement by cutting down a walnut tree, planing and curing the wood, then polishing it into a new hinge top just like the one he'd lost. On other organs, Conklin proudly points out a decorative handle, music stand, or volume control that he tinkered with, picking out work he did 20 years ago. Bystanders can't tell the difference between the parts Conklin restored and what remains of the original pieces. They marvel at both the authenticity of his work and the sharpness of his memory. But when it comes to making music with his organs, Conklin falls silent. He doesn't play the instruments. He leaves that job to Hartman, who explains that the organs work by forced air.
As you pump the pedals, the air is forced into the bellows and then drawn by suction over the small metal reeds. The tongues of these reeds vibrate as the sound, as air goes over them, making the sound.
To control different banks of reeds, the organs have as many as a dozen different stops, operated by porcelain knobs, which Hartman pushes and pulls to fit the sound of each piece of music.
Some of them add different sounds. Some amplify what you already have, like the couplers. But here's the violin. Here's the cello. Here's the harp. See? This is forte, means louder. And so that's what those
And the
do.
Whole time your feet are pumping at the bottom
yes,
to get it
right.
going.
That's right. And the diapason is the basic sound of an organ. Yeah, the swell and the grate that add extra volume.
You push mm-hmm. them with
and
your
extra,
knees.
Yeah. Yes.
So your knees are going, your feet are going.
Yes, no wonder they wore long skirts.
But not all of the organs in this collection are so complicated.
This is a suitcase organ. It was patented in 1904. It would date back then to the First World War. This folds up, the top folds down, the bottom folds up, and has two carrying handles, which is nice because it takes two people to carry it. And this was taken out on the battlefields during the First World War. This kind was also used for entertaining because it's very portable.
There's also a circuit rider organ, the kind a traveling preacher would carry from town to town. The medium-sized melodeons were popular family organs, and most of those in Conklin's collection are finished in rich rosewood. They have one foot pedal for expression and one to work the bellows, producing a sound that's a mixture of pumping feet and tinkling keys.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most unusual organs in this collection is a reed organ that dates to about 1870.
This has bells that are mechanical. As you strike the keys, a little hammers come up and hit the bells. That's controlled by one stop. You could put the stop in and play just the organ, okay? Or we can have the combination, which is, which we like real well. We also have a piece of music here that I always like to point out. It's called The Colonial Man. It was written by DeWitt Galloway Peabody, who was a Hanover person, graduated from this school. And this was copyrighted in 1906. I think anybody would enjoy it.
When Frances Hartman lectures to tour groups, she stands on the stage of the gymnasium-turned-museum, the same stage from which she graduated back when the museum was a public school. Hartman and the other members of the Hanover Historical Society are filled with memories of the town's golden years, and they're shaping this museum as a tribute to that era. The Society is restoring several classrooms to their original 1930s style and dusting off the old Hanover County switchboard, which, along with a few whoop and holler telephones, will serve as a hands-on display for kids. The handset type retrieved from the Hanover local newspaper will be the centerpiece of another exhibit. Eventually, this will be a slice-of-life museum that brings alive the simpler days of Hanover County. For National Public Radio, this is Marge Halperin reporting.